And you're all welcome to this Shabbat Bible study. It's November the 12th. And we're going to be looking at the plague of locusts and the selection of the end of where the Philistines have captured the ark and are sending it back to Beit Shemesh. And we'll be looking at what links those two passages together. To give some background, this is the triennial parasha, meaning that in Jesus' day, when they're reading through the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, they probably took roughly 3 years, 3 to 3.5 years to get through the whole five books. And then every week you have a chunk of a passage, and then that is coupled with a dessert, so to speak, from the prophets. And that's called the Haftarah. So you have the parasha and the Haftarah. Today we have all of that. It's in the yearly cycle. It finishes very neatly every the holidays we just had, culminating in Simchat Torah, where you rejoice in the giving of the Torah. So the interesting thing, though, is today, of course, to go through the whole Torah in 1 year, you got to take larger chunks. And they are connected to different prophetic passages. In the stuff we've been looking at, because they're smaller chunks, different things will be highlighted, and that will link up to different passages in the prophets, which is interesting for us to study because it may be the same selections Jesus and his disciples were studying. And some of the links you find are new. And for instance, I think we've already had in our parasha, one of our selections was linked up to Isaiah 53, which is a very famous kind of, you could put in quotes, Christian text. Because, you know, all we like sheep have gone astray. Everybody knows how Christians interpret that to see Jesus. That text is never found in the Haftarah today. And that is not by accident.
No.
But so it's interesting that this older parasha system kind of links up differently. And we've been having fun looking through it. So this week we are in Exodus 10. Let me just write up and we'll read it together. The whole chapter of Exodus 10, which, as I said, is the plague of locusts. And that's going to link up to our prophetic selection of 1 Samuel 6, 6-14. All right. So we'll go ahead and read these texts and then get into our discussion. So we will start, so you guys are sharing your Bible. Okay, so everyone's got a Bible. Let's start with Lewis. Go around clockwise today. Why not? Just everybody take whatever you think, a chunk of verses, 2 or 3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. This is Exodus 10, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go into Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may show these signs of mine among men, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I have dwelt harshly with the Egyptians, and what signs I have done among them, that you may know that I am the Lord."
So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh and said to him, "Thus says the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? Let my people go, that they may serve me. For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your country, and they shall cover the face of the land so that no one can see the land, and they shall eat what is left to you after the hail, and they shall eat every tree of yours that grows in the field. And they shall fill your houses and the houses of all your servants and all the Egyptians, as neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day they came on earth to this day." Then he turned and went out from Pharaoh.
Then Pharaoh's servants said to him, "How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet understand that Egypt is ruined?" So Moses and Pharaoh were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, "Go, serve the Lord your God. But which ones are to go?"
Moses answered, "We will go with our young and old, with our sons and daughters, and with our flocks and herds, because we are to celebrate a festival to the Lord." Pharaoh said, "The Lord will be with you if I let you go along with your women and children. Clearly, you are bent on evil. No, have only the men go and worship the Lord, since that's what you have been asking for." And Moses and Aaron were driven out of Pharaoh's presence. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over Egypt, so that the locusts will swarm over the land and devour everything growing in the fields, everything left by hail.
So Moses stretched out his rod over the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. When it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. And the locusts went up over all the land of Egypt and rested on all the territory of Egypt. They were very severe. Previously, there had been no such locusts as they, nor shall there be such after them. For they covered the face of the whole earth, so that the land was darkened, and they ate every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left. So there remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants of the field throughout all the land of Egypt.
Then Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron in haste and said, I have sinned against the Lord your God and against you. Now therefore, please forgive my sins only this once and in truth. The Lord your God, that he may take away from me this deadly omen. So he went out from Pharaoh and entreated the Lord, and the Lord turned a very strong west wind, which took the locusts away and blew them into the Red Sea, there remaining not one locust in all the territory of Egypt.
Go ahead, Lewis, go ahead again.
What's it, verse 20?
20.
Yeah.
But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand toward heaven, and there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, or darkness to be felt. So Moses stretched out his hand toward heaven, and there was pitch darkness in the land of Egypt 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did anyone rise from his place for 3 days. But all the people of Israel had light where they lived. Then Pharaoh called Moses and said, go serve the Lord. Your little ones also may go with you. Only let your flocks and your herds remain behind. But Moses said, you must also let us have sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Our livestock also must go with us. Not a hoof shall be left behind, for we must take them to serve the Lord our God. And we do not know with what we must serve the Lord until we arrive there.
But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he would not let them go. Then Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Take care never to see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, as you say, I will not see your face again.
There you go. What a dramatic finishing there. Okay, so let's go to 1 Samuel 6. Starting, let's see, should we start with the selection? Let's start a couple verses earlier to give you the context. If you remember, you all know where the Philistines were living, by the coast. It's like the five Philistine cities. A couple big ones, you may have been to Ashkelon. There's Gat, Ekron, Ashkelon, Gaza, Ashdod. Those are like the big ones. And the battle in Afek, kind of where, what is it, Rosh Pina is today? Not Rosh Pina. It's another Pina. It's near... what's the sign say? I'm not remembering it. Anyway, it's up north. It's near the river in Tel Aviv, but to the east of it, the Yarkon. Yeah. And there's Sidafek. Anyway, that's in the beginning of 1 Samuel 4, I guess. And you have this whole battle description, how they take the ark out from Shiloh, fight the Philistines. Yeah, it's Afek. It's Afek. The Philistines capture the ark and take it back to their cities, and it basically makes a round in all the Philistine cities. And everywhere it goes, it's causing problems. And so then this, we come into our selection here. Maybe we'll just go a couple verses back. Trying to get where they're... Let me start from the beginning. Welcome, guys, you just came in. We're in 1 Samuel 6, we've just read the locust and darkness plague, and it's being connected to this in ancient text. And so we're about to read the ark selection with the Philistines and figure out why they're connected. So let's begin from the beginning of the chapter, because it gives a better context. Beginning of chapter 6. So who was reading last? Okay, go ahead. Oh, yeah, Kevin, go ahead.
The ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place." They said, "If you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed. It will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you."
The Philistines asked, "What guilt offering should we send to him?" They replied, 5 gold tumors and 5 gold rats, according to the number of the Philistine rulers, because the same plague has struck both you and your rulers. Make moths of the tumors and of the rats that are destroying the country, and pay honor to Israel's God. Perhaps he will lift his hand from you and your gods and your land. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? When he treated them harshly, did they not send the Israelites out so they could get on their way? Now then, get a new cart ready with 2 cows that have calved and have never been yoked. Hitch the cows to the cart and take their calves away and pen them up. Take the ark of the Lord and put it on the cart, and in a chest beside it put the gold objects you are sending back to him as a guilt offering. Send it on its way, but keep watching it. If it goes up to his own territory, toward Beth Shemesh, then the Lord has brought us this great disaster on us. But if it does not, then we will know that it was not his hand that struck us and that it happened to us by chance.
Great. Okay, go ahead.
And the men did so and took 2 milk cows and tied them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of Jehovah on the cart and a coffer with the mice of gold and the images of their tumors. And the cows had took them straightway by the way to Beth Shemesh. They went along the highway, lowing as they went, and turned on the side to the right hand or to the left. And the Lord of the Philistines went after them into the border of Beth Shemesh. And they of Beth Shemesh were wheat in their wheat harvest in the valley, and they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark and rejoiced to see it. And the cart came into the field of Joshua the Beth Shemite, and stood there where there was a great stone, and they clave the wood of the cart and offered up the cattle for a burnt offering unto Jehovah.
The Levites took down the ark of the Lord.
Wait, we got. Did we get to verse 14? We did.
Yeah. That was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's great. That's enough according to our little selections here today. Thanks. So, you notice who gave this advice here in 1 Samuel, right? Who was it? Look back in the beginning of the chapter. Verse 2.
The diviners.
Yeah, the priests and the magicians, diviners. So basically, the council, the religious council of the Philistines.
Good.
And that connects maybe to Exodus 10, where it's Pharaoh's servants telling him, like, don't you get it by now? All of Egypt is being destroyed. Like, we have to get rid of these people. And it's similar to what has happened. We haven't read the previous chapters here with the Philistines, but similar things have happened to the Philistines, where they are very eager to get rid of this Ark of the Covenant. It's causing a lot of problems. But even then, okay, so their own ranks of officials are advising to get rid of them in both situations. But even then, there's a bit of a scientific experiment. So So tell me, what is this scientific experiment that they are proposing?
See which way it goes.
Okay. So I would say there are two controls to their experiment. Okay, so you're gonna send the arc.
There's nobody driving the cattle, they're just going on their own, right?
Exactly. No one's driving the cattle, right? You're gonna take a cart, you're gonna put a box with an arc in it, and all the extra gifts, golden, whatever they are. I'd be very, very interested to see what that might be. But I mean, rats are clear, the other part isn't. But so a bunch of golden images as some type of remembrance of what happened, the ark, a cart, and two cows. And what are those cows?
Milk cows,
meaning they are breastfeeding at the moment. They have little baby calves. And where are the calves going to be?
At home.
Locked up. So what are the chances those cows are going to want to go far away from the calves? Not too high, right? Especially if the calves start crying. So if you have them facing towards Beit Shemesh, leaving east of the Philistine territory, they could easily turn around to go back to their kids, or in this case, their calves. But they don't, so that's kind of counter-natural. Also, there's two of them, and you know they could easily wander off and feed different directions. But the text specifically says they went straight. Okay, so the first control is that they're breastfeeding cows, so they're not just going to take off and leave on their own. They're going to want to stay around. So the fact that they go anywhere to leave their babies behind is unusual. And that they go straight to the border of Israel. They're going straight up from the coastal plain right into Beit Shemesh. And that would be kind of miraculous. No one's driving them. So it is as if the ark is driving this cart. The ark is somehow leading them supernaturally. And so they've set up this experiment, and indeed it proves that it's God and not just chance.
Well,
so
that was what God told them to do, and as a result he took over to...
Who's following what God told them to do?
The people that are hooking up the cart and all that.
Well, God didn't tell them. Yeah, the Philistines came up with this idea on their own. However, God met their experiment. It kind of reminded me of Carmel, at the top of Carmel, where Elijah and the prophets of Baal, you know, they both set up their altar. And Elijah, what does he do? He makes it harder for God. He pours on water, not once, not twice, three times. This is like, there is no way you can claim that just a spark went off or somehow this happened by chance. You have to admit that it's God. And so I think the experiment that the Plishtim, the Philistines here, are setting up is one that you have to acknowledge it's God. There's no way this is chance if this happens, because it's counter-natural. It just wouldn't happen. So, and God pulls through. The ark is indeed a supernatural manifestation here, and kind of carries itself. He rides the cart all the way to Beit Shemesh. And if you notice, this is what struck me again today as I was reading it. The text says they're walking. The cows. They're mooing. They're like, so, to me, they weren't very pleased about going in the direction they were going. Like, to me, a contented cow doesn't moo that much. Maybe, you know, this isn't my field, but the picture I get in my mind when they're walking and mooing is like, I'd rather be back there with my baby, but I'm compelled to go forward. And so it's kind of funny. Like, it to me, that adds this supernatural driving. If you could see, if you were sitting in Beit Shemesh and all of a sudden these two cows are coming at you who don't look like they want to be coming, but they're just, shh, there they are, and there's the ark. It would be quite a sight. Okay. That's one thing that maybe connects up. If you look specifically, though, as Rachel was reading in our first verse of chapter 6, because we started before, we didn't get that first linked verse. So look at chapter 6, verse 6. Look there again. Now, I'm reading from the NET Bible. It says, "Why harden your hearts like the Egyptians and Pharaoh did? When God treated them harshly, didn't the Egyptians send the Israelites on their way?" Now, there's a bunch of stuff in this verse, I think, that link us back, besides the obvious mention of Egyptian and Pharaoh. And so, let me get an idea what some other verses have there. Do you all have "why harden your hearts like the Egyptians"?
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone have anything different? What do you have?
Why be obstinate like the Egyptians?
Why be obstinate like the Egyptians? Okay. Good. Anyone else?
Who's saying that? The priests of the Philistines?
The priests of the Philistines, exactly. These foreign priests are telling the leaders of the Philistines, hey, why are you being stubborn like the Egyptians and Pharaoh were? Don't you remember what happened to them? So that's also very ironic. Hey, welcome. So does anyone have anything other than "why harden your heart" or "why make your heart obstinate"? Because to me, this little verse is just a great, great verse. Because it says, it literally says, "Why do you honor your hearts like the Egyptians honored their hearts?" And lechabed is to honor in the Bible. There, as far as from what I checked, there's no other place in the Bible that lechabed is used to harden or make heavy. There is a word from the same root, lachbid, that is used repeatedly. In fact, in our plagues just recently, if you follow the last couple of plagues in chapter 8, verse 11, 8, 28, 9, 34, and 10, 1, the first verse of our selection, that is lachbid. That is to make heavy, to cause to be heavy. And that's repeated throughout the plagues. Hello, you can sit here. Gemma's not with us this morning. You're welcome. There's your seat. It's also open.
I don't want to bother you.
So we have this word that's been repeatedly used to make hard.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, heavy is better. To make heavy, to make hard. For any who care, here is a different word. Although, idiomatically, you could say it's used in the same phrase, to honor your heart. If you're obstinate, if you're being stubborn, you're basically respecting your own opinion more than God's, right? So in essence, it's the same thing going on, but it's using a slightly different way of saying it. And to me, it makes it much more poignant for me, because it's a nuance I can relate to. Like, when I am respecting my own opinion above God's, that's an easy thing to do, you know? And that's not too far away from what Pharaoh was doing. I mean, this is kind of, originally there was a hardening of hearts, and then this is talking about that hardening, but it's kind of playing with it. And if you, whether you know Hebrew or not, graphically, you can see there's three things that look the same, like sharing the root. So there's kind of a play going on here. And you have this play between honor and shame, or and disrespect. And if you want proof from another place in the book of Samuel that this text really says to honor your hearts and not to harden your hearts, why don't we look at 1 Samuel earlier in the book. Did I not write my... Sorry, I didn't write down my text. Should be around... It's where God's talking to Eli. Let me find it one second. Should be. Chapter 2, do you have a verse? I pulled the quote out without the verse. 1 Samuel. Yes, 2:29. Okay, 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 29. God likes to use poetry because it packs a punch. It really works nicely to deliver messages. And unfortunately, anytime you move from language to language, you can't do justice to poetry. It's just impossible because different languages have different ways the words sound nice together. Two words might relate to each other because they sound similar. You can make, like in English, we have, you know, let the sun shine on you. Or something like that. And if you're a Christian, you know there's a word son, that's the real son. There's a son of God. But they sound the same, so you can use those two things to make a play. So in Hebrew, this in the Bible, it happens all the time. But if you're translating this to another language and these two words don't sound alike, you're not going to catch the play. You're still going to catch the meaning, you know, it's translated well, but you won't hear the poetry. So that's the thing I'm talking about in Hebrew right now. But read 1 Samuel 2:29. Who wants, maybe, no, wait, Nicole, you got anyone with English? Go ahead, Sue.
Why then do you scorn my sacrifices and my offerings that I commanded for my dwelling and honor your sons above me by fattening yourselves on the choicest parts of every offering of my people Israel?
Keep reading through verse 30.
Okay, therefore the Lord, the God of Israel, declares, I promise that your house of your father should go in and out before me forever. But now the Lord declares, far be it from me, for those who honor me, I will honor. Those who despise me shall be lightly esteemed.
Okay, so lightly esteemed. There's, you have this contrast of honor and shame, or those who shame me will be lightly esteemed. Those who honor me will be honored. So how does it relate? How does this relate to our play? In this context, you're talking about sacrifices. The sons of Eli were taking the choice meat, which was not honoring to God, and it was also making them physically fatter, right? So they're getting fatter, which is this sense of heavy, back over there, but they're dishonoring God. So eventually, they're going to become light. They're going to become shamed. Becoming light and becoming shamed are also synonyms. You also have in the beginning of the verse, why do you kick against my offerings? So you kind of envision this stubborn cow kicking against the offerings. And so you see these two sons as if they were big fat cows. And God's saying, like, you fattened up your sons instead of fattening me up, basically. So you have this physical representation of getting heavy and light, but really what they're talking about is respect, honoring and dishonoring. And so I think something similar is going on here, where they're referring to the place that talk about making your heart heavy, but they're using the word that's actually honoring, because making your heart heavy is dishonoring God. It's honoring yourself more than you're honoring God. And believing your own idea more than his. So there it is. I don't know if I can make that as clear as I'm feeling it, but But there's another word in here that we have to look at, and that directly connects us up. If you look back in Exodus 10, I think it's in our first verse. Second verse, yeah. So God's going to do all these signs. He's going to harden Pharaoh's heart so that he can do these signs. And then the second verse, so that you will put in the ears of your sons and your sons' sons that I, Egypt. What do you, your Bible say?
Dealt harshly.
Good. What else? The NET Bible has made fools of the Egyptians. Anyone else?
The New King James says, tell your son's son and your son the mighty things I've done in Egypt. And it doesn't say the other.
It doesn't use a verb, just the mighty things I've done?
Dealt harshly.
Dealt harshly? Okay, so this is a word, lihit alel. And it's not so common in the Bible. So I thought that we could read a couple of passages where it occurs. It occurs seven times. And kind of get a sense for what it means from the other passages. So if you look quickly at Numbers 22:29. This is in the middle of Balaam. You remember he's riding his donkey to go meet Balak, who is the king of Moab. And the donkey keeps being diverted by God. And so in verse 29, anyone have it and want to read it?
And Balaam said to the donkey, because you have abused me, I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I will kill you.
Interesting. Because you abused me. I like that. Let me, just going to write down some of the things we've been throwing out. Deal harshly. What else did you say before? Now we have abuse. Mine head, make a fool. Make a fool. The NET version for the previous passage said, make Pharaoh fool. Here it says, and Balaam said to the donkey, you have made me look stupid. I wish there were a sword in my hand, for I would kill you right now. Anything else? Any other Bibles have something else in these?
In the NIV, the passage in Numbers is make a fool, but the other passage was dealt harshly. Is it the same Hebrew?
The same word, yeah. Yeah.
It's just interpreted
differently.
Yeah. Blue spice.
What?
Blue spice.
You
might make a fool of it.
Oh.
To lose face.
To lose face, uh-huh. Definitely. To make a fool, and he said here, make me look stupid. Yeah. Lose face, that's another idiom. Lose face, make me look stupid. Now, it's pretty, make me look stupid could be a tiny thing or a big thing. And I would go with the big thing because Bilam is so angry he wants to kill his Aton. So it's not just a tiny little, I'm just making fun of you. But this is the same word we're talking about. And so you can see, depending on the context, it can be interesting to translate, interesting to understand. There's another context that I think will very clearly put us there, and that is the Pilegesh Bagiv'ah. If you look in Judges 19:25, it's a harsh story about, remember the concubine? the Levite's concubine. Yep. Okay, verse 25. Who has it and wants to read it?
However, the man who listened to him, so the man took hold of his concubine and brought her out to them. They wrapped her and abused her all night long. Only at dawn did they let her go.
Okay, so they raped her and abused her. Okay. In Hebrew it says, they knew her and they, this word, Vayit aleluva, all night. So that word for abuse. Now in this case, the abuse could also be something to do with shaming, you know, making fun of, making a fool. They're kind of connected. And really, if you think of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is not using this word, there's a similar thing going on. There's the abuse is in order to shame. Okay. So, another context, we have a military context. Twice, we have two times it's told to us, the story of Saul when he's about to die and he asks his armor bearer to kill him. And that's in 1 Samuel 31:4 or 1 Chronicles 10:4. We don't have to look at both because they're the same. So 1 Samuel 31:4. Does anyone have it and want to read?
Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me. But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it.
Okay. So, did you catch that? Did you hear our word? It was mistreat me. Mistreat me, to me, sounds a little light. Especially after just reading the Judges verse. But this is the same word. Vehit aleluvi. And they will, my text here says, torture me. What do you have? Anybody?
Mistreat.
Mistreat. Well, it is mistreating, but it's very much mistreating.
Torture?
What?
Because he says that they're going to thrust him through, and then he finally will be. So
right.
It wouldn't make sense that they would torture after.
Yeah, torture we think of the person being totally dead. But you know, when you're first thrust through, I don't know how long it takes to die. But you're right. I think it's a post-death abuse, like you find in the Middle East, like in Iraq, when they like drag these bodies and burn them. And it's a shaming thing, right? And what did they do to Saul when he died? Do you remember? They cut off his head and they stuck it up. Yeah, it's a shame. It's abusive. It's after the fact. They're dead, but it's a shame to them. So he uses this word. I guess I should be writing these verses down for you just to make sure we keep them. So we had Bilam and his donkey. In Numbers 22:29, that was more lighter. We had the Judges 19, where was definite abuse. And here we have a military context, but it's also the same type of serious abuse. They're the same. And then in Jeremiah 38, we have another military context. The same fear that the enemy is going to abuse. Let's see. Mine again has torture. Does anyone want to read that one? Jeremiah 38:19.
King Zedekiah said to Jeremiah, I am afraid of the Jews who have gone over to Babylonians. to the Babylonians, and hand me over to them, and they will mistreat me.
Okay. Mistreat.
Abuse.
Mine says torture. All right, mistreat here, good.
It says mock me. Some of them have mock and some have
mock.
Abuse.
Yeah. Well, mock would be in this category. And again, there's a connection between the two. Because in all these contexts, the abuse is in order to mock.
They deal cruelly with me.
Deal cruelly. Okay. So, it's a pretty powerful word. That's basically, we've read all the times that particular word comes. There are other related words that can be similar in meaning. There's also the word to glean, le'olel, that's related, but not exactly this meaning. But maybe there could have been a connection at some point. Like to totally glean something is to strip them bare, which could be, you know, making a fool out of them, could be abusing them. Maybe you could see a connection there. But why did we go into all that word? Do you remember where it was in our text today?
Exodus 10:2.
This is what God did to the Egyptians. It's kind of harsh from our worldview today, but it is very, it's a definitive victory in the ancient world. And it's putting Egypt in its place. It's making a fool of them, it's abusing them, it's dealing harshly with them. It's quite strong. And that is the same word that the Philistines remember. And that's what they give in their advice in 1 Samuel 6. And so they say, why do you respect your own hearts like the Egyptians respected their hearts and Pharaoh? And he says, isn't it true that when God dealt harshly with them, they sent him away and they left? So the Philistines are saying, basically, God is dealing harshly with us in our Philistine towns with all these diseases we've had, in the very same way God dealt harshly with the Egyptians way back then. And we should learn the lesson from them. If God dealt harshly and the Egyptians sent him out, they left, well, then we need to send out the Ark of the Covenant and let it just get out of here so that we aren't continually abused, let's say. So I would say that those are the key things connecting these little passages, and they're kind of shorter today than some other passages have been. Did anybody see something else in these texts that either connect them or maybe something that stands out to you? Where in Jeremiah?
Jeremiah 38.
38, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's mocking or...
Mocking, right.
Mocking or ridicule.
Ridicule. Yeah. Ridicule. That's another word we can put up. We have so many words. The problem with English is that we've gotten words from so many other languages that we can have like 10 words to say the basic thing. Other languages will have more words, but they might have 3 or 4, and English will just have tons and tons, you know, ridicule, mock, all kinds of things. But these are all basically saying the same thing. Now, as you were saying that, I was thinking of something, but it left me. So, anyone else?
Exodus
we talked earlier how it's interesting that the plague of locusts wasn't connected up to Joel, right? Because we read Joel, it was connected to a previous plague. And you're like, well, that has locusts there. Why wasn't it connected? But here, it's exactly these two concepts that connect it. So I guess the locust isn't the main point. Now, there is another thing you could say that connect the two, if you're thinking more poetically, and that's the sacrifice. How does, in the end of the ark coming back to Beit Shemesh, what happens?
The cows get sacrificed.
Yeah, I was feeling a little bad about that this morning. Like,
what about those babies?
Poor cows, those babies. It wasn't a temporary separation, it was forever. Of course, I guess the Philistines will have to then eat the babies.
Who's doing the sacrificing? The people in Beit Shemesh? They're Israel?
The people in Beit Shemesh, yeah.
But that's Israel, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Israelites. That was the border. There was like Nahal Sorek. If you go down there in the valley, you can kind of see even the land, like the Mishor, the flat land on the coast was Philistines. And then it starts to enter Shvelah. You're right there in that big valley with Beit Shemesh. That was kind of the border. So they followed the ark right up to where they saw the border, and then they went back kind of to their territory. And of course, that's a homeland of our other hero, Samson. He lived on the border. You notice his stories. He's always dealing with Philistines. A little bit too much. What else to you stands out, thinking back into the Exodus plague, the locust plague?
I like the way the wind was used to control it.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
A lot of wind.
The west blew it in and
east blew it out. Into Yam Suf that they're going to cross. So that's also a question, where Yam Suf is in relation to where these plagues are going on. Today, we refer to Yam Suf as the Gulf of Eilat, you know, the Red Sea, which is a reed sea. But there is some question what Yam Suf was in the text, whether it was a smaller sea. Because the word yam in Hebrew can be like a big lake or an ocean, so you don't really know which. There was another thing, though.
Locusts destroyed everything that was left, right?
Yeah.
There was a hail didn't destroy because the hail destroyed some of the grain, the locusts destroyed the rest.
That's actually the other thing I noticed, is the timing of the year is Shavuot. Because if you look at the Ark story, they're coming back in. What are they doing in the field? They're harvesting wheat. And it specifically says in our Exodus text, what does it say? What do the locusts destroy?
It's certain grains, isn't it?
Yeah, which certain grains?
The hail destroys the other
one. That's right, the hail destroyed the other one. So tell me what they are. Okay, so look down in verse 15. And first it destroys all the greenery. And so they mentioned, well, the hail could have, like, got the upper branches of the trees, but there's still roots underneath.
It says the hail destroyed the flax and the barley.
Exactly. Yep.
The wheat and the rye were left.
And the rye? Wow.
Mine says rye, R-I-E.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting.
But they were left, so they became mature later.
Yes, they did. It's chitan kusemet. Earlier was kusmin and pishtan, which I would say spelt and flax earlier, and wheat and buckwheat later. But it does give you a timing, right? Because the wheat is the later harvest. And so Presumably, here in the land, that would happen around Shavuot time. Obviously, this in Egypt is all happening before the first Pesach. But Egypt's a little lower and a little hotter, so maybe the wheat is going to be riper early. And so you have this, that also connects the two texts, because here it is harvest time. So you could say there's some type of connection there. Harvesting wheat. Only one, but it's like a contrast, because here the Israelites are harvesting the wheat and enjoy it, and there their wheat is being obliterated and destroyed. Is there any other connection you see?
Yes.
What?
No, referring to the locust.
Locust, okay.
What brought it is an Easter wind.
Right.
So, you know, according to scientific discovery, that the locusts move from east to west.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, you know, another thought. There is a reference in Revelation about the locusts, you know.
Yes, there is a reference in Revelation about the locusts.
These plagues might be take place at end of time. And many theologians, they apply the locust in Revelation as the Islamic invasion of the country, or coming from the east, conquering towards the west.
Well, the east, yeah, you got to be careful how you apply your eastern wind.
No,
the eastern wind is dry, and it comes from the east. But the point here in the Exodus plague is still that God is sending the locust. He's using wind, right? He's sending it from one, and then he gets rid of it the other way. There's a divine action in one direction and the reversal of that action. And you could say that both of them prove it's divine. If the locust just fell on Egypt, you could say, oh, this freak wind just came, and now all of a sudden we have all this locust. But the fact that it was reversed after prayer, taken away the opposite direction, to me that's part of this setting up an experiment that proves it's God.
Look at the event of, in Revelation 9, what does it hurt, you know?
Uh-huh. But is there an east wind in Revelation 9?
Read it by yourself, Revelation 9.
Okay. I'm just saying that if it's locusts, there are many other places in the Bible that talk about locusts destroying. That is a metaphor and will continue to be used as a metaphor, and certainly in Revelation. And there could be hints back to our plague account. I'm not sure we could press the eastern wind, western wind kind of thing. I don't see that picked up in Revelation. And eastern wind, I mean, we have it in the book of Jonah. It comes, dries up the Kikayon.
But we know the Islamic invasion and all, it came from the east towards the west. Even to the,
okay, a lot of things have come from the east towards the west.
And Spain.
A lot of things.
Hijaz.
Depends where you are.
It depends where you are in the world. East and west is relative, yes.
Could be scaring thought, but theologians with different ideas.
It's always kind of been funny to me that, you know, in songs about leaving Egypt, you always hear, let my people go, right? Those are the words. But every time it says that, it says, that they may serve me. And you never hear that. Let my people go, that they may serve me. It's interesting, huh? Just let my people go. But there's this sense of, like, you're leaving serving Pharaoh to serving God. And that's why Pharaoh keeps going back to this. You know, so who exactly is going? Well, if you're really just going for a sacrifice, just your men need to go. And like, no, we all need to go. And well, then leave your flock behind, you know, as like a picadon. What is it?
Like
insurance, like you leave
money.
Yeah, you leave a little bit behind to make sure you'll come back. And then when Moses and Aaron say no, it's obvious, I guess, to Pharaoh that they're intending to go. And leaving to serve God is basically saying, we're leaving you forever.
Don't some of the Egyptians go with them too? They have like this, they call it a mixed multitude, the left with you.
There were some. I haven't read that text this morning, but I do vaguely remember, yes, you're right, there were some Egyptians that went with them.
And what was required of Pharaoh was to humble his heart.
Yes.
And so basically that's what those people did.
That's the other thing I wanted to say. That word to humble your heart. Let's find it. Show me that verse again.
That verse is Exodus 10:3.
Exodus 10:3. That ties into the same theme of heavy and honor. You know, kavod is honor. Kaved is heavy. And then there's humble, and there's to make light of something is to make them look lower than they are. But this word, this is a different word, to humble yourself is le'anot. It's interesting.
It's not humbling the matter.
Well, I'm sure it's, what is it in Arabic?
Arabic taqba.
Which, how would you say that in English?
You mean to accept, not to accept.
To submit?
Submit, yes. Submit.
Okay.
So when you submit,
you humble yourself when you admit, in a sense, yeah. But le'anot, if you're going back to playing with the words, le'anot.
You know, to accept by force.
it can also be to be, this is the same word of affliction that we looked at before. Lechem ha'oni, the bread of poverty or the bread of affliction. So there is a kind of overlap in people's ideas between being poor, being afflicted, and being humble. You're humble when you're poor because you're forced to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so this word that they're using, that we're saying humbling your heart, it's the same word of to be the down guy, the poor, the humiliated even sometimes, the afflicted, the underdog. I don't know how you could express that in a translation.
If he did humble, why more plagues come upon him?
I guess humble in English is also connected to poor and humble.
Why don't
you could use that in poetry.
It's something he didn't do.
No, he didn't.
No, he didn't do.
Does anyone else, by the way, have a different thing than humble yourself?
Submit.
What?
I have a submit.
To submit. Okay, like the Arabic.
He refused to do it. That's right.
Yeah.
So could it have the same meaning of submission as making another usage of the root when the angel tells Hagar in Hebrew, should we be in Zadim?
Yeah. In the Hagar story, though, I would even say it's stronger than just submit yourself. Let yourself be afflicted again, even. Because Hagar ran away because she was being afflicted. She was being kind of put down. There's maybe a spectrum of... You could submit to a good master who wasn't mistreating you, or you could submit to someone who's really mistreating you. And in this case, I guess it's submitting to someone mistreating you because you're getting thrashed, you're getting punished. Pharaoh's getting punished, and he's still not submitting.
That kind of ties in.
No, but Pharaoh didn't have a choice.
Why not?
Because in the first verse, he says, "Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart."
Sure.
So when his fault that his heart was hardened. God hardened his heart.
Okay, but if you look at all the plagues, you will see that's also a spectrum. In the beginning, Pharaoh hardens his heart. Sometimes it just says, hardening his heart. It doesn't tell you exactly who's hardening the heart. And then it says God hardens his heart. So there's you could see progression there. Or there's at least a back and forth that makes it seem it's not all God and it's not all Pharaoh. There's a combination.
That's why God pardoned Pharaoh. And since Pharaoh, before the plagues fall, the order, all the children, male children of Israelites, be killed. So his heart was hard.
His heart was already hard.
Ever since, before Moses.
No, it's clear to me that Pharaoh hardened his heart. But it also says God hardened his heart, and I think what he's pointing out is at a certain point, God's like, well, you're going to be stubborn. I'm going to keep you stubborn a little longer so I can show my power so that people really remember this, and then we'll have
Exodus. From the very beginning, his heart is hard.
Pharaoh's heart is hard.
Because he has older.
But you know, even if your heart's hard in the beginning, the more that happens to you and you keep it hard, it can get harder and harder.
It's like a seared conscience.
Yeah, a seared conscience can get harder and harder.
That's really dangerous, because then God turns you over to it.
Right, right.
There is an element of his refusal, at least in verse 3. The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says, basically, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me? That ties in with our Samuel Lekabed. Basically, how long are you going to refuse to honor yourself over me?
Right.
And that's a take-home message for all of us, basically.
Yeah.
Will we choose to honor our own heart over God, or will we?
Yeah. Because obviously, we're not God, and hopefully God wouldn't harden our hearts on purpose as followers of God, but we do still have our hearts in our control that we have to not honor more.
Actively choose to humble. This is implying that Pharaoh does have a choice.
Yeah. And we're out of time, but remember also, every time we talk about heart, I don't know what languages you come from, but a lot of people in English, heart means feeling, love, I don't know what. Heart is, in the Bible, everything. It's your mind, it's your will, it's your emotions, your intentions. That's your heart. So when we're talking about honoring your heart over God, it's not just honoring... You know, it's everything in your life, the way you make your decisions, what you feel, it's all combined. So it's a powerful message to me.
Spiritual love, and
spiritually, for sure.
It's also interesting that Pharaoh, he was like the authority.
Yeah.
And God was saying, I'm even above the authority. You know,
for sure. Right.
But there comes a balance. If there's a choice between God and authority, God comes first.
Well, the point is, if you don't... you're talking about... I see what you're saying.
In general, you know, you can't go around... like they're doing in the States now, rioting because Trump got elected. Well, give me a break.
Right. No. Sure. And with that... Shabbat shalom.
Okay, thanks.